Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning on Two Jewish are Rachel Brosnahan and Michael Ziegen, the stars of the new Amazon TV series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish mavina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our shinshinim, Chen Dinachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This weekend, we celebrated Thanksgiving. And it turns out that this quintessential American holiday is actually Jewish and closely related to the upcoming festival of Hanukkah. Now, first, any holiday where you get together with your whole family, including those relatives you don't really like, and overeat, is by definition Jewish. Next, historians tell us that our pilgrim forefathers based Thanksgiving on the Jewish biblical celebration Sukkot, the harvest feast of booths or tabernacles. The Mayflower Puritans studied Hebrew with a Sephardic rabbi in Leiden, Holland before sailing for Massachusetts. When they decided to thank God for their first harvest on Cape Cod, they modeled their festival on Sukkot, an outdoor celebration of gratitude. Interestingly, Hanukkah, which begins the evening of December 12th, just 2.5 weeks from now, is also based on Sukkot. When the Maccabees recaptured the temple in Jerusalem, cleansed it, and rededicated it, they held an 8-day festival of Thanksgiving. Based on the pilgrimage festival, they'd been unable to celebrate while the Syrian Greeks controlled Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. So they celebrated Sukkot late that year. The practice caught on, and it became the holiday of Hanukkah. So, on this Sunday, enjoy your leftover turkey, and while you're at it, give a prayer of thanksgiving to the one God who gave us the wisdom to celebrate all three of these wonderful festivals of gratitude. To play us in this morning, here's our first preview of Hanukkah music. It's the wonderful setting of Ma'oz Sur, the Jewish Rock of Ages, by Benedetto Marcello, as performed by the Zamir Chorale. Was the Zamir Chorale performing Benedetto Marcello's gorgeous setting of Ma'oz Sur for Hanukkah, coming up in a little more than 2 weeks. We have a very special show this morning. Our guests are two of the stars of the outstanding new TV show from Amazon called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, actors Michael Zegan and Rachel Brosnahan. It's the best new show I've seen in a very long time, and one of the best shows I've ever seen, to be honest, and an extraordinarily Jewish show about comedy and life. It's from the creator of The Gilmore Girls, Amy Sherman-Palladino, and you have to see it. And meet Michael Zegan, one of the very Jewish stars of the show, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish our guests this morning, actor Michael Zegan, who is one of the stars of the extraordinary new comedy, well, more than a comedy, great show, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is premiering very shortly. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing great. So it's a tremendous show. I'm a little biased because I like Jewish shows. I like comedy. Not everybody in the cast, which is a very Jewish show, is Jewish. Tell me, do you get consulted a lot? Tell me how that plays for you.
I wish I had gotten more consulted, but no, they have now kind of a Jewish consultant on the show who tells Amy and Dan if they're, you know, if they're doing everything right. But if there is something that arises that I don't necessarily think is correct, then I'll speak up. I should have done it during the pilot episode. There was like a scene with the pork chops, but I was like my first day and I didn't want to get fired. So
yeah, I saw that, but
everybody mentions that. Anybody who's Jewish is like, what is she doing at a non-kosher butcher?
And exactly. For, you know, and then the rabbi's
like,
coming over. Yeah. That's
yeah. Right. It was like, you know, especially during that period of time, I feel like she, you know, she would have made sure, but you know, nobody's perfect. So,
first of all, it's a great show. You've been successful. You've been on successful TV shows before, Rescue Me, for example. This time you play a guy who's both attractive and kind of awful. How does that feel when you get to do that?
It's a character, so you know, it's something I hadn't played before. I never played a stand-up comedian or an aspiring stand-up or you know, so it was great. I mean, I don't see him as awful per se, but I think that he's got a lot to learn and he's young and you know, he's just making some mistakes along the way.
Was it a little terrifying to play a stand-up comedian?
I think playing a stand-up comedian is kind of fun. If having to be one is an entirely different thing. It, you know, that terrifies me. But playing one, you know, with an audience who's there specifically just to laugh is really wonderful.
And of course, Bob Newhart wrote the routine in the first place. So,
I knew I was in good hands.
I don't want to give too much away. At one point, you know, you really kind of succeed, and then you have this scene where you don't succeed as a comedian.
Yeah.
You know, that's of course every actor's nightmare, to get out there and the response is bad. How does that feel to play that kind of a situation?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because. So I kind of had a panic attack during my bar mitzvah, and
like for real.
Yeah, for real.
I know a rabbi who can help you, you know, work through that process.
It kind of came out of the blue because I was, you know, always acting when I was a kid. So nothing like that had ever happened to me before. And I got up there and I don't know what happened, but everything started spinning. And so I kind of was able to use that for my bombing set. And I think it worked. I was like transported back there. I really was. And it actually, I wasn't planning on it, but it just happened. Again, like everything started spinning and I was really in it.
You know, the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel set in New York, almost all of it feels incredibly Jewish. Some of the actors like Kevin Pollak are Jewish, have done a lot of, you know, Jewish material over the course of their lives. Some of them are absolutely not, like Rachel Brosnahan. Was there a difference in the interactions for you?
No. I mean, you know, everybody's playing a character. I don't think it really mattered one way or another. And you know, if anybody had any questions, like I said before, I could answer them. But I don't think that was a big deal.
You're a second generation survivor. Your grandparents are Holocaust survivors. What kind of a job is this for a nice Jewish boy, a second generation survivor, to be an actor? How does your family feel about all that?
You know, I remember when I was 10, I did a play, and I think I did Annie. And I remember my grandfather was like in the second row, and he had a huge smile. So I think he liked it. He always used to introduce me as the actor. So yeah, I think he enjoyed it because TV was something that I kind of grew up watching, and I know like he loved TV. So maybe, you know, maybe it kind of just kind of took away all the bad memories, and I think that it was a joy for him to watch my progress, my career progress, and unfortunately he passed away when I was just graduating high school. But he used to love going to see me act, and my grandmother's still alive, and she loves it. I mean, she'll tell everyone. I mean, she'll go to a garage sale and tell people that I'm an actor, and you know, all of a sudden
stopping people on the street and the butcher shop.
Seriously, it's gotten problematic. Like I tell her to stop. Like she'll come up to, you know, she'll call me and be like, well, I met this guy and he really wants an autograph. And I was like, well, how did that even come up? And she's like, well, he came over to, you know, fix the air conditioner. And I was like, yeah, and how did it come up? And you know, and she's like, he asked about it. I'm like, no, he didn't. Nobody just asked you if you have a grandson who's an actor. But you know, she has pictures of me around, so maybe they recognize me or something.
Well,
but
no,
it happens a lot.
I think what happened is, you know, the air conditioner was pretty close to the television. She just happened to mention that her grandson is on television.
And it's funny because, like, even times I'll tell her specifically, you know, we'll go somewhere. I'm like, don't tell anyone I'm an actor. She's like, no problem. And then 2 minutes later, it's like, oh, my grandson right here, he's an actor. Tell him about your career. It's like, you know, but I get it. She's proud, so.
Well, she should be. She's shepig nachas, as we say in Yiddish. You know, this is not the first Jewish character you played. On Boardwalk Empire, you played Bugsy Siegel.
Yeah.
A little bit different kind of Jewish character.
Yeah.
And you've also played, you know, zombies and other kinds of characters, of course, as an actor. Is there anything special about playing somebody Jewish?
Well, it's just, I think it's a world that I know. So, yeah, it's just a little closer to home, and I don't know. I mean, like, yeah, I think that is the special aspect of it. But you know, like, getting to play Bugsy Siegel, that was just cool, because you know, rarely do you see Jews portrayed as these tough guys.
Right.
So to be able to do that was just kind of, I mean, he was nuts. So I don't know if that's a good example. You know, he was not necessarily a good guy, but. But yeah, I do. I just think that it's something that I can identify with, and it feels kind of natural to me.
When you're hired to do a part, what's your favorite part of that, about that process, about, you know, deciding how you want to do the lines, how you want to play it?
Well, if given the opportunity to kind of make my character my own, then that's really what I look forward to. You know, I do consider myself a character actor because I like playing different types of characters. I don't want to be the same thing over and over again. I mean, getting to live in these, you know, worlds where, you know, these different eras, these different periods is always really exciting to me, and especially this, it's the 1950s. I haven't really gotten to do that much, and getting to, you know, act when you're surrounded by these old cars and the old sets and the costumes and everything. I mean, it's just, it's all exciting.
There's a lot of smoking because it's the
1950s. Oh, yeah, right.
Was that strange?
Well, I'm not a smoker, so it's not my favorite thing in the world. You know, they always use these herbal cigarettes, and they actually, like, I think taste worse than real ones. And they burn a lot faster, and they're always, the ash is always getting in your eyes. So it's hard, like, acting when your eyes are burning. But I think that's also just the time period. I think a lot of people smoked more. I mean, they were, you know,
Everybody smoked, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
I think everybody in the cast seems to be having a really good time doing this show, even when there's dramatic, powerful moments. Is that true?
I hope so. no, we are. Yeah, it was. It was a really good time, and everybody, you know, everybody's really professional. Everybody likes to have fun, and you know, everybody knows their lines. And I felt like, you know, we're part of a team, so it's great. It's a really good group of people, and everybody's so talented, and you know, I don't think there's any weak link necessarily. So it really is a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to seeing where these characters go.
How far in advance do you know? In other words, how far out have they run the arc of the characters?
I know nothing. They don't tell me anything.
So, like, you get the script, and each episode is its own experience.
They tell you bits and pieces. You know, then there's going to be a scene where this happens, stuff like that. But other than that, I really don't know much, and I don't know anything about next season, like literally nothing. And that's, I don't mind that. I think it's kind of exciting.
Rachel is kind of the heart of the show because she's the one who has to do the stand up and show that, but there's so much talent around her. Has she ever done stand up comedy?
No. And I told her that she should try it, but she refuses to. And actually, Amy said she would write her a set and to do it, but she refuses. I don't know why, but you know, it's terrifying.
Look, live theater is terrifying when you have the lines, right? But
yeah.
But stand-up comedy, you're doing your own material, and there has to be some flexibility to it. There are so many, actually, comedians who've made it as actors. It'd be very interesting to see somebody cross back over.
Sure, yeah. But I mean, I think that for me personally, it's more terrifying being yourself than you know, playing a character on stage. Which is probably why I had the panic attack when, you know, during my bar mitzvah. I like theater because I get to be somebody else. And yeah, I mean, obviously it is terrifying, but it's so rewarding.
One really interesting aspect of the show is just how fast the dialogue comes.
Yeah.
That seems unusual to me in a TV show, even unusual in theater, just the incredible pace of it. Does it seem that way to you when you're doing it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, especially because, you know, half the time you finish a scene and then Amy comes over and she's like, pace it up. And it's like, really? Like, I thought, you know,
I thought I was fast. I thought I was doing New York.
Yeah, I thought I was fast, but I guess not fast enough. So, I think that's a very theatrical element of the show too, and that's why it feels like a play. You know, each scene feels like a one act, and it's kind of what I'm used to because I did do a lot of theater and I have done a lot of theater, so it's kind of comforting in a way. It feels natural to me.
I want to thank Michael Ziegen. Sorry, I can't do
Ziegen,
that.
Yeah.
By the way, where does the name come from?
Good question. It's a Dutch word meaning blessing or blessed, something like that.
So kind of bracha, if you will.
Yeah, well, I am a Kohanim, so it does kind of make sense in a way. But yeah, it's a Dutch.
So at some level we're related, but a few generations.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I want to thank Michael Ziegen for a great visit here on Too Jewish. And we'll talk to Rachel Brosnahan a little later in the show. But the show is called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and everybody should watch it, Jewish or not. Thanks again, Michael. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast top 10 in North America, according to Moment magazine.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about Israel and the remarkable diversity, the integration of Arab citizens all through Israel, which is taken for granted in Israel and not understood, I think, abroad. You know, who has these weird perceptions of apartheid, which is not at all the way it is there. But that's not the only diversity within Israeli society today.
Right. Absolutely. Both Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, which are the two cities where I spent my entire time on this trip, have visible large populations that are not European in origin. There are any number of people in healthcare services, home care services, et cetera, of Philippine, Thai, et cetera, origin, Southeast Asians. In Tel Aviv, at least, probably also in Jerusalem, but maybe less visibly, there are lots of people from Africa, Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, whatever. Not only people who are Jews, like Ethiopian Jews, but also people who are political refugees or economic refugees or just come to look for work. So there's a phenomenon that's kind of the browning of Israel, if you will. There are a lot of people of color from the Southern Hemisphere, and they've opened restaurants. In many cases, they're great economic successes. And there's another type of diversity as well. Obviously, there was a huge wave of immigration from the former Soviet Union. But not only from the former Soviet Union, all of its satellite countries. So in a hotel or a restaurant or a bar, you'll run into people from Poland, from Bulgaria, whatever, whatever. And there's also a large number of people from countries in South America which have Jewish populations, but have representatives in Israel who are not necessarily Jewish, but there are Argentinians in the wine industry, Brazilians in the hospitality industry, whatever, who are there as part of multinational companies like Hilton or Intercontinental, and they're working, they're part of the economy, they're not Jewish, they're not making aliyah, they may not be permanent, but they add to the rich diversity of life in the big cities of Israel. It's quite impressive.
It is, and you know, when you consider that Israel, first of all, is a country with Jews who have come there from something like 200 countries, many of which don't even exist anymore, mm-hmm. to live, making it a very diverse place. By the way, that makes the food really interesting now.
Right, absolutely. You know, Israeli food used to be falafel and shawarma.
At best.
And now it's like everything, everywhere. There are far more non-kosher restaurants than there used to be, so that opens like a lot of possibilities. And a lot of these immigrants, you know, have married Israelis, and so there's a fusion of like Yemenite and Thai cuisine or Brazilian and Polish cuisine. I mean,
right.
Amazing places.
Moroccan and German cuisine. It's pretty fascinating.
Right. And it's also, I mean, for me, it's a pleasurable opportunity. You get into a taxi, you tell the driver where to go, and three words of his response tell you that he barely speaks Hebrew because he's a new immigrant from the former Soviet Union.
Right.
So you switch to Russian, and you say, where are you from in the former Soviet Union? And he says, I'm from here. Where are you from? Arizona. No, can't be. Your parents were from Russia, right? No. You know, and so you have these funny conversations again and again with new immigrants from all over the world who speak heavily accented Hebrew, and you can tell in three words where they're from.
You know, one last add on that. You mentioned you flew that flight, the nonstop from Tel Aviv to San Francisco, and that it was completely sold out with people in the high-tech industry going back and forth between Silicon Valley and the Herzliya corridor of all the high-tech firms in Israel.
Right.
And by the way, lots of Asians, of course, in that context.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Na'an Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And happy Thanksgiving weekend.
Chagodaya Sameach.
Chagodu Sameach, in every sense. Turkey and Thanksgiving. We started talking last week about a really fascinating book, Catch 67 would be the English translation, about the 67, the kind of circular problem of Israel and the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
You laid out very beautifully the way that the author talks about the history of it coming out of the Ottoman Empire, the sense of Arab pride, and this Jewish fear of destruction. Where does he leave us? Where do we go? Where do things sit now, in his opinion?
So one of the things that he talked about is the 67, the, you know, what led to 67, what was exactly after 67 in terms of, you know, and it was like the question, are the shtachim are really occupied or not, because in order to since the Israel it wasn't like a war that we initiated, we just reacted, you know. And for instance,
yeah,
you know,
Jordan Israel attacked Israel, Egypt massed
Jordan,
troops
Israel
on
was
the borders,
very very clear,
you know,
with Israel and send the message, don't be part of it,
right.
and
Hussein felt pressured and he attacked,
yes,
and
they attacked
the,
and then we
lost the West Bank. And
Israel had no, you know, other choice other than to fight back Jordan and, you know, take the land or occupy the land. But the definition, and that's what he's going as an historian, the definition of being part of the book is like if it's really occupied or not. And his opinion that, not his opinion, but his analysis is it's not being occupied because we never asked for this war. So we never asked for this land. And he goes back to the partition plan that's been, offered by the UN to both Israel and the Arabs. And the Arabs said, no, the Israelis said, yes, we will take whatever
going back to 1947.
47.
Now, right.
And then, you know, so it was, the Israel side accepted the partition plan and the Arabs now. And since then, and he goes one by one, since then, every offer, every peace agreement, any, you know, whatever, if it's Olmert or Barak or whoever, whatever we offered, it was never, it was always like, no, no, no. And we go back to the no, 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 the triple no in 67, immediately after the 67 war, that is, you know, the Khartoum summit, when Israel offered, take back the land and let's have peace. And they said no for negotiation, no for peace, and no for Israel recognition.
Right. Correct.
So that's basically, you know, the state of mind that, you know, the Arab world, you know, represent in this.
So this is a fascinating year, 2017. You know, we had the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War. We had the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. What nobody's really talking about is also the 70th anniversary of the UN Partition Agreement. I know the 70th birthday of Israel will be
in 2018.
But it really started in 17,
October,
you know, with the UN Declaration.
November 29.
So it's all of these things coming together. It's easy to stop at no. But if you just stop at no, then you end up in this catch 67, as he describes. Is there hope in spite of that?
Next week.
Thanks, Ashra.
Thank you, Rabbi.
a great lead-in. We'll talk next week.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie is stopped by an usher entering the synagogue. The usher asks, "Are you a friend of the groom?" And Sadie replies, "Of course not. I'm the bride's mother." You see, the bride's mother is definitely no friend of the groom. Anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Family dynamics play a central role in the whole book of Genesis, from Adam and Eve and their sons Cain and Abel, through the intricacies of Joseph's awful relationships with his many brothers. You can easily claim that the Torah teaches us all about family life by showing us how not to do it. but the most complicated of all the families of Genesis. And remember, we began the book with the first older brother in history murdering his younger sibling. The most complex and intricate of all the dysfunctional family groups we encounter is surely that of our great ancestor Jacob, his four wives and 13 children. In this week's Torah portion of Vayishlach, Jacob returns to his homeland of Canaan, someday to be known as Israel, when he hears rumors of the approach of his fearsome and feared brother Esau, who is headed his way, accompanied by 400 armed men. Jacob is in a panic, seeking to save at least half his family from utter destruction. He divides his household in two, and in the darkness of the night, before his coming encounter with Esau and his mini-army, Jacob crosses alone to a small island in the middle of a tributary of the Jordan River. And there he encounters a representative of God, perhaps a man, perhaps an angel, perhaps a spirit from a dream. The text is ambiguous, but one thing is clear. This enemy wrestles Jacob all night, and when neither can prevail, they reach a truce as dawn breaks. That truce includes an important change for Jacob. He is given a new name, Yisrael, Israel, which means one who wrestles with God. Jacob, now also called Israel, goes on to meet Esau, and the brothers resolve their lifelong differences. It's an important act of forgiveness and reconciliation, tshuva, a kind of modeling that will matter for Jacob's own children when Joseph and his brothers ultimately reunite a generation later. The rest of Jacob's family life remains problematic, filled with conflict and complexity, tsoras and heartbreak. But at least one example is created of a way to emerge from the pain of family struggle. If we first learn to encounter God, to wrestle with the divine, then we may be able to find our way back to those we love. When we return on Too Jewish, our second guest this morning, Rachel Brosnahan, the breakout star of the new show on Amazon, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, will explain what it's like to be a stand-up comedian when you really aren't one. Find out when we come back in a moment, right here on Too Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Rabbi Rick Jacobs, president of the Union for Reform Judaism, and other Reform Jewish leaders were pushed, pulled, and had clothes torn by security guards as they tried to pray at the Western Wall Plaza, the Kotel in Jerusalem, last week. The Torahs they were carrying were also pulled on, although they did not surrender them. The guards and Haredi ultra-Orthodox worshippers tussled with the group last week as it entered the main entrance to the Western Wall Plaza with Torah scrolls. The guards said it was illegal to bring Torah scrolls into the main plaza, which it's not. Reform leaders accused the Haredi ultra-Orthodox administration of the holy site, which employs the guards, of denying their right to freedom of prayer. Rabbi Rick Jacobs, a past guest of Too Jewish, said that during the clash, a guard put his finger on the trigger of a bottle of pepper spray and put it up to Jacobs' face. His suit jacket was also ripped as guards shoved him and pushed against him. Israeli Reform leader Gilad Kariv, also a past guest of Too Jewish, accused the administration of acting like thugs, said the violence will not stop us from fulfilling our right to pray at the Kotel. This Reform group began prayer in Robinson's Arch, the non-Orthodox or pluralistic section of the holy site on the south of the main plaza. They then tried to enter the Kotel area itself with the Torahs. They ended up finishing their service in the main plaza, the large tourist area removed from the wall but next to the Orthodox areas for men and women. A group of Haredi protesters also shoved some of the worshippers then. That group included the board of Hebrew Union College in Jerusalem, which had just ordained four new rabbis and members of the Women of the Wall feminist prayer group. The brief fracas caused no injuries. Reforming conservative groups have repeatedly challenged the rules of the Western Wall Heritage Foundation, leading to sometimes violent confrontations. They have criticized Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's government for backing out in June from the 2016 agreement worked out by Natan Sharansky to expand and upgrade the Robinson's Arch prayer section at the southern end of the wall into a pluralistic, egalitarian area for all Jews. The ultra-Orthodox Haredi parties and Netanyahu's governing coalition demanded the move. We belong there, we have a right to be there, and the Jewish people and state of Israel will be strengthened when the country, the Western Wall, is truly welcoming to Jews of all beliefs and practices, Jacobs said. At the Jewish Federation of North America's annual General Assembly last week in L.A., the Board of Trustees passed a resolution calling on Israel to reverse its divisive and damaging steps to freeze the Kotel deal. Netanyahu addressed the controversy in a speech at the closing session of the conference. Israel is the home of all Jews and must remain so, he said. I believe the Jewish people are all one family. I believe that Israel is the home of all Jews and all Jews should have access and prayer at the Kotel. Except that there was just such an agreement for the Western Wall, and Netanyahu chickened out. Continuing a story we've been following on Too Jewish, this past week over 400 works from the collection of Hildebrand Gurlitt, the German art dealer who traded in degenerate art on behalf of the Nazi government, went on display at Switzerland's Kunstmuseum Bern, as well as the Bundeskunsthalle in Bonn, Germany. Gurlitt's collection of 1,400 artworks discovered in 2012 has been the subject of steady controversy over concern that many of the works were ill-gotten and taken from Jews during the Holocaust. Gurlitt was a complicated figure in the mid-century art world. In 1933, he was fired from his position as a curator at Hamburg's Kunstverein for exhibiting expressionist painting and refusing to fly the Nazi flag. He had some Jewish blood. Yet he later elected to work with the Nazis as one of only four dealers chosen to market the degenerate art, quote-unquote, abroad. During this time, he gathered an impressive personal collection at a tremendous discount. In 1940, he actually purchased 200 paintings for just 4,000 Swiss francs total from Josef Goebbels' propaganda ministry, the Nazi ministry. After the war, Gurlitt successfully presented himself as a victim of the Nazi regime. Found work as a museum director by 1948, he covered up the existence of his personal collection, claiming to have lost it all in a fire in 1945. That collection resurfaced in 2012, as reported on Too Jewish, when German authorities burst into the Munich apartment of Cornelius Gurlitt, Hildebrand's son, who died in May of 2014. The Germans took custody of the collection, which contains works by Marc Chagall, Kathy Kollwitz, Paul Klee, among many more wonderful artists. When a German magazine broke the story in 2013, it caused a sensation. The German government has funded research into the work's provenance, though their investigation has been criticized for lack of transparency by both the World Jewish Congress and the Jewish Claims Conference. So far, the German government task force assigned to discover which of the works has been stolen from Jews found only six of Gurlitt's purloined artworks to be looted and worthy of restitution. This seems preposterous to most rational people, of course, and especially to Jews. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish another special guest this morning. Rachel Brosnahan is the star of really my new favorite television show of all time, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much for that.
Well, I have to say, when I got the pilot, kind of the promo piece on it, and I thought, well, it can't be this good, and then got to look at some of the shows, and it really is fantastic. Have you ever done any stand-up comedy before?
Absolutely not. Nope, never, and I never will.
You're good at it.
Well, I can't claim to have ever actually done stand-up. You have to understand that what I did, first of all, I'm not playing me. I'm not putting myself out there. I'm playing a character. And in the most controlled environment you could possibly imagine, if I screw something up, we get to do it 27 more times, and there is an audience that is literally paid to laugh at my jokes. I can't claim to have ever had that amount of courage.
I have to say, as a rabbi, I wish I had an audience paid to laugh at my jokes. That does sound pretty good.
There is hope for you yet. There's still time.
You
became prominent in House of Cards in a very dark, kind of different sort of role. This is really a completely different experience. You like it?
It is. It's very different. I have loved it. I have been utterly petrified every single second of this job, but in an exhilarating way, in a way that I didn't even know I was craving. Yes, I have loved every minute of being a part of this.
There's a scene, I don't want to give away too much, in which you're talking to the character, Lenny Bruce, the guy who's playing Lenny Bruce, and you say, "Do you love it?" to him. And he has a wonderful little monologue about how horrible it is to be a stand-up comedian. And then you say again, "Do you love it?" And he kind of shrugs and you say, "Yeah, he loves it." Did you love doing this show?
I did. I'm so grateful that we get to do it again come this spring. because we've been picked up for 2 seasons by Amazon.
Mazel tov, by the way.
Thank you. I have loved every minute of being a part of this job. We have one of the most incredible crews I've ever worked with. Every single person involved with this show, from the people at the top, from Amy and Dan and our producer Dana, to the hair, makeup, wardrobe, costumes, all the way to the background actors. Everyone makes this show come alive, and it has been a really special experience.
So this might be the most Jewish show I've ever seen on television.
Yes, sir.
And you're not Jewish, so tell us about what that was like.
Yeah, so I grew up in a really non-religious household, and I grew up, though, on the North Shore of Chicago.
Highland Park, as I understand. There's a few Jews in Highland Park, I'm pretty sure.
There are many, many, many. It's a predominantly Jewish community, and growing up, I really was welcomed with open arms into this culture and community. All my friends were Jewish. I think I've honestly probably been to about 150 bar bat and b'nai mitzvahs. I was welcomed into seders and Shabbat dinners and Hanukkah celebrations. So when I read this script and met Amy and began working on it, it felt familiar to me in a way that I have loved. And was surprised at how little research I had to do about some of the very inside humor that that we have on the show.
It's also an extraordinarily New York kind of show and a period piece set in the late 50s. You know, I'm sure hopefully it'll work its way into the 60s. How was that? I mean, everything New York always seems Jewish to everybody, but this really is.
Yes, it is very much so. You know, Midge is a born and bred New Yorker. She lives on the Upper West Side, and it's a huge part of her identity, both New York and being Jewish in New York. And yes, New York is like a character in and of itself in this show.
Well, the apartments are actually almost characters, too. Those were, oh my gosh. When your agent comes in and says, "What, I didn't realize I was meeting the Queen." There's a culture. There's a kind of a cultural gap too, a class gap that's kind of played with in the show.
Absolutely, yeah. Midge has led a very privileged life, and the downtown scene. Although she's been downtown quite a bit because she and Joel kind of met going to comedy and loved going to comedy together. It's foreign to her still, and people like Susie are not people that she would interact with normally.
You know, stand-up comedians often become actors. Not too often that actors get to play stand-up comedians successfully. Your delivery is spectacular, partly the incredible pace of the show. I talked about that with Michael Ziegen a little bit earlier in the show. I don't think I've ever seen a show with faster dialogue in my life.
Us either.
How was that?
Crazy. It's like speaking a different language sometimes. It involves many a mouth warm-up in the morning, and there's a lot of footage out there of us tripping over ourselves and nearly biting off our tongues. But it's true. It really contributes. It's one of the things that makes the show feel so magical when it works, is that it's its own unique style, and that's thanks to Amy and Dan.
In preparing for this, the person who comes to mind is Joan Rivers, just another very fast New York Jewish comedian, but she, and a woman comedian when women didn't have a lot of success as comedians. But your character is kind of the opposite. Joan Rivers is always making fun of her appearance and her face, you know, the surgeries and all this stuff. And you're beautiful. It comes across that way. You're confident of that. How was that to kind of develop that persona? Or was that something that Amy and Dan did?
I think that the majority of that is thanks to Amy and Dan. It's mostly on the page. But yes, that's exactly right. I think while Joan Rivers is somebody who's known for being bold and brash and talking about things that were taboo at that time, and that's something that she and Midge ultimately share in common, her comedy comes from feeling like she never fit in. She was an ugly duckling by her own definition. And Midge is somebody who fit in better than everybody else by her own design. And so they're very different in that way. I think personally, I drew inspiration from a lot of the research I did on a lot of the comedians at that time, and also some women in my own life that I have known and loved. But it's so nice to work with a creator like Amy, who has such a crystal clear vision for this show and for who this character is. And that makes my job easier.
That may make your job easier, but you are absolutely spectacular in this role, I have to say. Like, you just sort of jump off the screen. I don't care what size the screen is. And I saw it initially on a computer monitor. You know, there's something to being at the center of everything. Whatever scene you're in, and you're playing with tremendous actors, you just kind of jump out. Are you aware of that? Is that something you try to do, or is it just kind of the way it's structured?
I really think that so much of this character is on the page. She's an extraordinary woman, and she's been created, written, directed, and produced by an extraordinary woman and an extraordinary man who loves extraordinary women. And I feel lucky to be the woman chosen to help bring her to life. But that means a lot to me, so thank you for saying that.
So talking about extraordinary women, I hope it's okay, but you are the niece of Kate Spade. That makes you sort of related to David Spade. Did he help at all?
So David is very distantly related. So the way this breaks down, which sounds really complicated, is that Katie is my dad's sister.
Okay.
And Katie is married to Andy Spade, and David is Andy's brother. So I don't really know David. I think we met once when I was a kid, but he's out in L.A. and traveling all over doing work, so we've never really had very much interaction. But maybe I should reach out to David at some point and ask him for a tidbit or two.
I don't know. I don't think you need much help.
Thank you.
So in your performance, and again, I'm trying not to give away too much, but you not only cross boundary lines verbally, but physically. How was that to do?
Well, I think one of the things that I love so much about this project is that when it comes to moments like that, I'm incredibly selective about nudity and specifically hypersexualization of female characters. That's something that really bothers me on screen. And so I didn't question the moment that you're referring to, because it feels organic to the character and to the script. The instances of nudity in this pilot are, they're not sexy at all. they are sad and funny. and that moment specifically is Midge hitting rock bottom. And so, it felt like a part of the storytelling, an organic part of the storytelling.
Is it more interesting to take a character who starts out low and then rises, or to take somebody like Midge, who starts out at the top of the world, goes down to the bottom, and then has to come back up?
I think they're both interesting. I think I've sort of played with both, and this was a specific version of that story that I've never done before. And so that was a welcome challenge to me. But I think they're both exciting, and both stories that need to be told.
Did you enjoy the costumes? Do you enjoy the costumes? I mean, it's such a stylized show.
It is. Yes. Yes. A resounding yes. Our costumes are incredible, incredibly uncomfortable, but incredible to look at. And really, they're transformational. They change the way I walk, the way I carry myself, the way I feel. And they've been they're a huge part of this show, and are brilliant, brilliant costume designer, Donna. I don't know if you know this, but these costumes were all made from scratch.
Oh my gosh.
I'm going to say 97% of Midge's costumes are not vintage, in fact, but they were designed by our crazy genius talented Donna, and these things just fell out of her brain, inspired by French Vogue, vintage French Vogues, and Audrey Hepburn and Elizabeth Taylor, and she created from scratch this very unique look for Midge. The costumes were extraordinary. Certainly one of my favorite parts about being
on this
show.
It seems totally correct, since it's set in part in the Garment District.
Yes.
And you get the whole Jewish Garment District part of it also. It's the, you know, you're working with some very talented, very experienced actors who've, you know, received multiple awards and stuff. Were there some aspects of that were your favorite? Were there people that you really loved working with? Was some of the patter complicated?
Oh, no, all of them, all of it. This group of people is one of the loveliest, kindest, most generous groups that I've ever had the privilege of working with. And I say that a lot because I've been extraordinarily privileged to work with many extraordinary, kind, and talented groups. These guys are amazing. They have been so supportive and so warm, and they're so talented. Watching these guys find these characters and perform together has been a constant source of inspiration for me.
So I'm going to come back to the stand-up, because that's in some ways the core of it, although all the interactions are great. If you haven't seen this show and you wouldn't have seen it yet, you definitely want to see it. It's going to be something you're addicted to. Standing up there in a nightclub, even if it's all scripted, did it ever feel real, like you could really bomb?
There's a certain degree of nervousness, certainly, particularly the first couple of times that we run those scenes with an audience there. It is different from rehearsing it in my trailer or dressing room with an assistant helping me run lines, because the audience is new every day that we do one of those sets. They've never seen this before. And although I don't have any experience. Alex Borstein once said to me, which I think is interesting.
She plays Susie, and she is spectacular.
Susie, yeah, she's incredible. She once said to me, she's done a lot of stand-up, and she once said that a stand-up comedian could never have played this part. Because when you do it over and over again, or the audience gets pulled out because of sound or the camera and they're not there anymore to respond to you, a stand-up would want to sink into a hole and die. But I, as somebody who's never had that experience and doesn't really know what it means to bomb or what it feels like in that very specific way, it was something that didn't have as high of stakes in that way.
I want to thank Rachel Brosnahan for a great visit. I feel we'd go on a good deal longer, but we're out of time. The show is The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and it is fantastic. And I think, although you're already a star, I think this is going to just bring you up to the stratosphere in our rabbinic humble opinion. Mazel tov on a great show.
Thanks for taking the time to chat with me.
It's a great pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Steve Leder, the senior rabbi of Wilshire Boulevard Temple and author of the new book, More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Top 10 Jewish podcasts in America. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes for the coming holiday of Hanukkah from Matisyahu, the appropriately named reggae star, his Hanukkah anthem, Miracle. My friends, may you have a wonderful Thanksgiving leftover experience, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Just living.
shine in the miracle. Candles in my vehicle. 8 nights, gonna shine invincible. No longer be divisible. Born through the struggle. Keep on moving through all this hustle. Head up, head down through all of the bustle. New York City, wanna flex your muscle. Look so down, look so puzzled. Huddle around your fire through all the rubble. Bound to stumble and fall, but my strength comes not from man at all. Bound to stumble and fall, but my strength comes not from man at all. Do you believe in miracles? Am I hearing you? Am I seeing you? Say, ain't nights and ain't lights in these fights keep me right and bless me to the highest. Until tomorrow, wipe away your tears and your sorrow. Sunrise in the sky, like an arrow. No need to worry, no need to cry. Light up your mind, no longer be blind. Him who searches will find. Leave your problems behind. You will shine like a fire in the sky. What's the reason we're alive?
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.